We return now to continue to investigate the dark mysteries of the past. We will discover new fragments of knowledge, some perhaps not so commonly held. We will explore how the pieces of the puzzle begin to come together and formulate for us an understanding of some of the most significant events and entities the galaxy has known. And with that knowledge, we might hope to come to a further understanding that the knowledge needed to save humanity need not necessarily come from the Emperor and his lapdogs like Rogue or Dawn. In some respects, this process has already begun. What we will explore ties in very well with my last thoughts on the Emperor, that he was arrogant to believe that he alone could be the saviour for humanity, or indeed that he still very well could be. Even now, the Mechanicus of Mars, after the events of Cadia, have begun to explore and harvest the material known as Blackstone, for this could hold the key to sealing the void that has torn the galaxy apart. The Necron knew this, and they'd used it for millions of years to hold the warp at bay, as well as their enemies and psykers that are an anathema to them. The Eldar knew it too, for the Eldar would also be among the first to use it in the crafting of the Blackstone fortresses, otherwise known as the Talismans of Vol. Vol being the Eldar smith god, the finest craftsman ever known, he would be responsible for some of the Eldar's most lasting achievements, but the tale of his and their gods is one of betrayal and tragedy. It is of course true that the Eldar were once very much at one with the warp itself. They did not fear it as they do now, they embraced it, bathed in its energy. It was only when they came to understand the power and subjective evil that could be brought into existence therein that allowed them to see why they must treat it with care, even retreat from it to a degree. This was long before the fall, with the passage of time and stirring forces within the warp who had finally unleashed the means of their own destruction. We will ultimately reach our goal of concluding the Chaos God's origins in Part 3. Today though we'll be talking extensively about the Eldar, and you would be fair in wondering why. Well, for one, it should be obvious by now that the Eldar have had a huge influence across the whole history of the galaxy. They have been far more involved with the warp than many other races, but this is not the only reason. There are other important factors, and through exploring the Eldar we can understand more and learn about the warp and psychic forces. The Eldar culture is rich and fascinating, as is their history and mythology, but most specifically we'll consider the souls of their kind and all mortal races, and it is by positioning the events of the galaxy upon one another and by comparing differences between the Eldar and humanity that enables us to reach the most logical, in my opinion anyway, conclusions regarding the Chaos Gods. There is so very little written about the Chaos Gods' origins and about the nature of things like time in the warp as we looked at previously, and we'll expand on this further as well in the third video. And when you have so little direct information, it's necessary to approach matters almost by a process of elimination. Whatever you're left with after discounting all other factors, no matter how improbable, must be the truth of things. Luckily for us, I think the conclusions after linking all the information available, not all that difficult or improbable. Lastly, in reference to the War in Heaven, it's most commonly known that there are two periods known as the War in Heaven. The first war between the Old Ones and the Necron Tyr, and later between the Old Ones and Eldar versus Catan and Necron. As you may be aware, this is confusingly not the only periods that are referred to as the War in Heaven. And one other thing that seems to confuse many is that the Necron Tyr and Necron are not always referred to as such in a clearly defined way in relation to their history. What I mean by this is that some races like the Eldar seem to still refer to them as Necron Tyr even in the current age, even after they've suffered through the process of bioconversion to become Necron. So this can be really misleading, because if you read Necron Tyr as always referring to the early pre-Catan period, this can make things in terms of time very muddled. So as always, knowing the context around who they're referring to is fairly important. And we'll begin by exploring something that I've long struggled to fully comprehend, because there is a great deal of contradiction and subjective interpretation surrounding Eldar mythology. It also has no definitive timeline order or even real structure. Yet the Eldar mythology is of importance to us because it deals with some of the first warp creations, and it's deeply connected with the very center of who the Eldar are as a race, and indeed their own origins. Most importantly though, through exploring the Eldar, as I say, it helps us come to further conclusions about our ultimate goals, the Chaos Gods. How would they come into existence? No one will likely ever truly know now. From the fragmented scraps of information that survive, it is said that they were the first to walk among the stars of the galaxy. mysterious beings remembered now by a rare few, and they were the Old Ones. They were the creators. They would seed worlds with life. They saw the value in all living creatures and beings, and they were eternal. They were not constrained by the passage of time, appearing godlike to some, yet they were also mortal. These benefits not apparent for those with whom they shared the galaxy, the ancient race of the Necrontyr, its people ravaged by the extreme solar radiation damaging their DNA, fundamentally altering their race genetically, crippling their lifespan. The Necrontyr's planet orbited too close to their sun, and for this, they suffered greatly. Their society became obsessed with escaping this inescapable sentence of death, their only option seemingly to escape their homeworld, and as they set out to explore the galaxy, they did so in stasis ships, because they had discovered to their horror that this generational damage had shortened their lifespans, and no matter where they travelled, they were followed by this shadow of death, and this greatly limited the expansion of their race. Yet expand they did. But even when they were free of their damaging proximity to the sun, they could not escape the eternal shadow hanging over them. When the Necrontyr would finally encounter the Old Ones, they would learn of their seemingly immortal lifespan. Consumed by envy, they were desperate for the knowledge that would enable them to turn the tables of fate. But the Old Ones resisted them. This was their knowledge. It was not for the Necrontyr. The Necrontyr as a race had been strong through its unity, but as they expanded, they became somewhat fractured over millennia, some vying for independence from the ruling Triarch, and this would lead to what was known as the First War of Secession. The ruling Triarch struggled to maintain control, and in an attempt to prevent the civil war that was already spanning entire realms from turning into an outright disaster, they needed something to once again reunite their people as they had been before, something to allow the heavily damaging self-destruction to cease. They saw the ideal way to achieve this would be by using the bitter resentment that had grown from the Old Ones' rejection of gifting the Necrontyr their secrets of long life. The Triarch would unite their people with this goal as their prize and wage a war against these stubborn and much hated First Ones. And it was this First Galactic War which became known as the War in Heaven. An important detail I feel is often overlooked is that the Necrontyr had highly advanced technology, even at this time. It's certainly questionable that they may have found other means to extend their lives if they were given time, and it was only the desire of the ruling Triarch who wished to prevent the disintegration of a unified Necrontyr. So, while the Old Ones' secrets of long life were their superficial goal, this was not the main objective, a fact which in retrospect seems much more troubling given the events which would ultimately come to pass. While the Necrontyr were an advanced race by this time, their technology was still no match for the Old Ones, who would use a powerful technology of their own, known now as the Webway, to travel vast distances with ease. The Webway is essentially a space that exists outside of material space, but separated from the warp. It enables those within to pass from one area of the galaxy to another with extremely reduced travel time. Not entirely dissimilarly to something like a wormhole. Travelling through the Webway, though, is also achieved by psychic power. It also operates as a psychic communication net, not simply pathways to travel through. So this enabled the Old Ones a powerful tactical advantage to always be a step ahead of the Necrontyr, not just in movement, but knowing and talking and communicating about where they're going to be. And this meant the Necrontyr could never make any real gains versus the Old Ones. Eventually, the Necrontyr would be pushed back to their own star system, and the Old Ones, having bested them with ease, now considered the Necrontyr to be nothing more than an irritation and a civilization who, if necessary, could be pushed back again. The Necrontyr, as a result of this miserable defeat and failure to acquire the Old Ones' secrets of extended life, would descend into yet more infighting. And this would consequently herald the Second Wars of Secession. The governing Necron Triarch were now desperate to again maintain control and avoid the already weakened Necrontyr civilization from just tearing itself apart, or what little now remained of their crippled civilization. As fate would have it, a means to accomplish this would become apparent for them, except the Necrontyr could never have imagined the cost that would be demanded of them in order for them to achieve the goals they now sought more bitterly than ever. For the Necrontyr detected strange entities that appeared to be feeding on the very stars of the galaxy. They had for the longest time studied and paid close attention to the star of their own system, and upon noticing some strange occurrences, it is said that the Necrontyr either found a way to contact these beings, or that their burning hatred for the Old Ones sang out so strongly across space that it would attract these entities. The truth of such matters is not particularly relevant, but what seems to be the case is that these beings, when first discovered, were in fact fairly passive, or at least unaware of such things as mortal races. They were just entities who had existed since the dawn of time, who were hungry for sustenance, and they had seemingly found this through the energy of stars themselves, which they would then devour. Knowing that to truly understand the mortal world, these beings could never comprehend without manifesting in a form similar to their own. And the Necrontyr used their knowledge of living metal to forge bodies for these dark star gods to transfer into. These incomprehensible forces were compressed into the false living metal bodies provided by the Necrontyr, and these entities were the Catan incarnate, taking the form of the Necrontyr's half-forgotten gods. The Catan provided the Necrontyr with more advanced weapons and inertialess drives, sidestepping the problems that had hindered them in the past. The Catan known as the Deceiver would come before the Necrontyr leader, the Silent King. And this Catan claimed that they had fought the Old Ones before and lost, and they had a desire to, together with the Necrontyr, wage a war against the Old Ones again. An alliance that would not only reunite the Necrontyr, but achieve their long sought after prize of immortally long life. If any of this were actually true is unknown, but despite some in the royal court of the Necrontyr raising concerns over this alliance and what it might mean for their race, the Silent King would agree to the alliance. The immortality the Necrontyr had desired for so long was revealed to be not as they had imagined. The Catan would give the Necrontyr what they wanted, but only through a process of biotransference. And with the pact sealed, the Necrontyr began the process of entering the colossal biofurnaces that never ceased in their operation of harvesting the life of the Necrontyr, processing them and leaving them trapped in bodies of their own living metal. The Catan swarmed these sites and feasted upon the life energy of the Necrontyr. But not all of the Necrontyr would go so willingly, because they were still a sentient, free-thinking race at this time. When it eventually would become clear that no amount of persuasion could appease those who resisted, those individuals would attempt to rebel and resist, but would ultimately be crushed. These surviving rebel Necrontyr would be dragged against their will into the vast biofurnaces to have their identities stripped away. These resistance Necrontyr dynasties would later be punished for this by being placed in campaigns that had slim chances of success, and despite their regenerative ways, would suffer the most damage. Much later in time, when the Necron would turn against the Catan, these leaders of their people, these resistance who had kept some semblance of their former selves, would fight the most ferociously against their godlike leaders. The Silent King realized he had made a terrible mistake, one that now could not be reversed. Like many Necrontyr reborn, he felt invigorated and refreshed to be rid of the aches and fears that organic life brought with it, but at the same time he felt somehow hollow, empty. And he came to realize that this was no passing feeling, that feeling of an empty void, and that this process had not been simply the stripping away of organic material, it had been the stripping away of his soul. That the Catan had consumed all of the souls of the Necrontyr. They had lost all that they were, and now only existed as soulless automatons, known as the Necron. Yet the Necron in these new bodies had achieved what the Catan promised. They were immortal, and disease or damage from their sun's radiation were no longer going to be a threat or a concern for them. They were indeed united, though perhaps not how they originally envisaged. The Necron had been embedded through their creation process with command protocols that forced them into loyalty to obey the Silent King. Empowered from their gluttonous orgy of devouring what had been the Necrontyr, coupled with their powerful army, the Necrons, the Catan, and Silent King waged war upon the Old Ones, in what would become known as the Second War in Heaven. The Catan, now at full power, unleashed forces beyond anything that can be comprehended in the modern day of the Imperium. Across the galaxy spread the ancestors of the living dead raging war against the Old Ones that had been the creators and protectors of the infant Eldari. They dominated the galaxy and the Old Ones were totally besieged. Worse, the Catan had found an ever-plentiful source of sustenance as the races that had been crafted and nurtured by the Old Ones now became like cattle for the hunger of the Catan. It is even said that amid this orgy of destruction, the Catan fought amongst themselves for their entertainment. Planets were razed, suns extinguished, and entire systems devoured by black holes via the reality-warping powers of the star gods. It is even suggested that as mortal races became more scarce, the gods would turn on one another until only a few remained. The Catan seemingly somewhat preoccupied with their galactic war of destruction against everything and even themselves were not paying as focused attention to the Old Ones as had been their assertion to the Silent King, and this lack of focus again raises the question of just if they had indeed fought a war against the Old Ones in the past, or was this just some kind of manipulation to ensure the Necrontyr would provide them with the sole energy they needed to launch this galactic gorging. The Old Ones were by now desperate and needed a means to try and turn the situation around. For the longest time they had seeded life across the galaxy for the sake of creation, and they believed all life to be of value, yet now they did so with an urgent and necessary purpose. They would create many new life forms, but among the most important of these would be the Eldar, the Eldari. Despite the ongoing war in heaven, the Eldar would grow into a race with great potential over millennia. And not always under the watchful guidance of the Old Ones, who were forced into returning so as to continue fighting the war in heaven. These early Eldar would reach into the Immaterium, perhaps as was their nature, and which at this time was far more accessible, apparently overlapping with reality, not clearly separated as it is today. Their natural born talent enabled them to play and experiment with the warp, learning to use it in crafting their works and culture, which were of course glorious to behold. But these peaceful times would not last, as the first ones returned from the darkness beyond the sky, their strange and vast vessels scarred and worn. Their presence had dimmed from what the Eldar remembered. The Old Ones returned to inspect their Eldar creations. Were they ready to join the fight? When they discovered the Eldar's warp experimentation, they would encourage the Eldar to reach further into the Immaterium and discover ever more skill and creativity therein. Now, here we interject with an important tangent. We leave our main historical timeline and put a pin in our place, where the Old Ones are now desperate and hopeful that their psychically powerful Eldar creations will be able to aid them. Because now we attempt to deal with the Eldar mythology and what this all means. There are no truly definitive guidelines on the origins of the Eldar gods. However, we know that Asurion was the ruler of their pantheon. He is described as the embodiment of all psychic power in the universe, and it seems reasonable to position him as the first. Modern Eldari of the 41st millennium are often referred to as the Asuriani, or the Craftworld Eldar, as they are the descendants of Asurion. The Inari are the disciples of Ennead. Now, firstly, much to the annoyance of all, some of the myths surrounding the war in heaven and the Eldar are deliberately contradictory, and that many of the tales and surrounding mythology, even with the best and most conscientious documenting and rationalising, leave us far from any concrete conclusions. It's also important to remember that most of this takes place 60 million years before the current age of the Imperium, and that even for the Eldar, the truth of these times is at this point distorted, overlapping, and simply very clouded. What this means for us is that sometimes, even when there is a reference to something, it could even within the lore itself be mistaken or muddled and originally meant to reference something else entirely, so any and all of these references from this age, this mythological age, should be viewed with a lot of scepticism. Now, keeping this in mind, most often when people read about tales of Eldar mythology, they often, and to be fair, understandably, take them purely at face value and very literally. Most would assume, for example, that the Eldar gods, as described, were sentient walking entities, because they're spoken about in that way, much like how you might see an avatar of the Eldar in the modern 41st millennium, or say a demon prince or even a greater demon of chaos. So you get the general idea. Except that often, with any religion from millennia before, these tales and myths are often not meant to be taken literally. They may instead be an allegory, that is to say a story with another or a hidden meaning, perhaps more moral or simply an emotionally described history lesson for future generations. The very simplistic literal interpretation of the Eldar gods had been how I saw this all for a long time, because firstly the Eldar have seemingly always presented it as such, and secondly I never bothered to put a great deal of thought into it. Not to mention that one of the most difficult things about Eldar mythology is that it's fragmented all over the place across decades of books. So there's not a single account somewhere which just documents the whole thing. I always envisaged the gods as powerful, semi-sentient, psychic weapons created by the Eldar, because this is referenced and it fits well within the intentions of the Old Ones. Now that part of it is still entirely plausible, especially remembering that when the Old Ones came to creating the newer races like the Eldar and the Krork, they were desperate and backed into a corner. The Catan and the Necron had been decimating them, and the Old Ones, powerful as they were seemingly not as powerful with the warp as their soon-to-blossom creations, the Eldar. The Old Ones were, I believe, well aware of the dangers this new race could represent. But when you're backed into a corner, often calm, rational, and reasonable thinking goes out the window. And that seems to be what happened. The Old Ones essentially gambled that the Eldar would be their salvation. They had achieved either accidentally or deliberately in creating a race that had immense psychic power and sensitivity with the warp. And we have nowhere near enough information to know just how competent the Old Ones were when it came to creating a life. Were they just seeding planets almost at random and waiting to see what happened? Or perhaps they had the knowledge to be able to craft specifically exactly the life that they wanted? Given how they're seemingly revered figures, I would lean in on them being very adept at this. But at the very least, I would guess they had a level of competency in genetic manipulation. Regardless, on seeing the potential power held by this burgeoning race and then in realizing this was just what they needed to vanquish the Catan, the Old Ones, in their desperation, encouraged the Eldar to develop their emergent warp skills, and to do this as fast as possible. And this is where things become even more unclear. It's very possible that the Eldar had created weapons from the warp that channeled and worked with their natural psychic ability. It's also possible that by working closely with the Eldar, some of the Old Ones who had more of an affinity with them came to be viewed as gods, or that the Eldar created entities that were beyond their comprehension during this time, forging entities on instinct rather than learned experience and knowledge. And then in so doing, the Eldar perceived them not as their own creations, but as gods who had sprung forth from the warp to aid them. It is also possible that the Eldar collectively unintentionally created sentient beings with godlike qualities, but that these were reflective extensions of themselves. We know that the warp reflects the thoughts and collective feelings of mortal and psychically sensitive creatures, yet this is a point of contention, because you remember that very common question about why are there no good gods in the warp? Why are there no positive chaos gods? And if the Eldar gods were created by the Eldar, this seems counterintuitive to our understanding of the warp manifesting negative traits. But the answer to this is fairly simple. The warp, in the 41st millennium, the age of the Imperium, is a hellscape that anything positive born into it would be immediately shredded, consumed or worse, before it knew what was what. Now, this also becomes problematic because we start dealing with the issues of time, but the evidence we have in terms of their mythology and what is talked about, you can assume that the warp was very different at that time. But this is really what I was talking about before in the first video, which is that we seemingly have linear descriptions of periods in time, yet in the warp there's supposed to be no time and all things can happen at any time, and so trying to reconcile those two things together and make sense of it all in any way is very difficult. So instead, you kind of have to say, well, we're just not going to worry too much about that, and we're going to look at what we have, a documented linear timeline in terms of just history or mythological events, whatever it is. We're going to look at the information described there, and then from that, because it's something tangible, we're going to draw our conclusions. So as I said, the warp in the 41st millennium is a hellscape. But if we were to see entities formed by positive and constructive attributes, it's likely that their consciousness would be entirely peaceful and positive. But it's precisely because of this that they're unable to even comprehend acts that we would see as being mildly negative or aggressive actions. They would essentially be extremely naive and ignorant of reality because they're formed from untainted goodness and purity. And this would surely lead to them then being brutally murdered without giving any resistance, which ultimately seems like it would be the case if anything good were to be born into the warp in the 41st millennium. Anyway, why mention this at all? Well, because when the Eldar were at their earliest stages of development, the warp was seemingly a very different place than it is now. Not a nightmarish hell, but instead a peaceful, beautiful sea of psychic energy. And how do we know this? Well, for one, just by logical assumption. And the other are relative descriptions, because there are no descriptions in Eldar mythology during the beginnings of their race of horrors consuming them or having to battle against untold entities, nor did they fear for their souls as the modern Eldar do for by now the well-established reasons of She Who Thirsts. There is nothing to suggest otherwise that I have seen, and the only descriptions of any dangers or predators in the warp come much later, toward the end of the War in Heaven, but not at all during this early period, or even throughout the Eldar's establishment during the War in Heaven. So what we can conclude is that during this early emerging period for the Eldar, it's very possible that they were able to manifest, either intentionally or not, positive creations from the warp that represented powerful characteristics of themselves. And these were their gods, such as Asurion, Isha, and Vol. Yet simultaneously, they also brought forth gods like Cain, the god of war and destruction. Except that Cain was not a being constructed from the darkest of dark desires. He was brutal, yes, but brought forth as a representation of the Eldar's need to express and feel the need for violence and war. Not necessarily as purely negative as it sounds, but more as most, if not all, mortal creatures can feel the need for self-preservation. And this feeling, this instinct, is, as we know, an extremely powerful one, a baser instinct that's lying there in you, waiting to be used. And that link, that technical description of how that functions, is very critical. But of course, for the Eldar, with their powerful emotions, this was a much stronger feeling. And it's possible that some of the entities referred to the Eldar gods could have been, or were at one time, old ones. Perhaps they were old ones initially, but as the Eldar shifted their own perceptions, later these were reassigned. It's unlikely we'll ever know any of the specifics of these matters with certainty. There is, though, another idea tied to these fluid identities. And I would say that this was semi-speculative thinking, because it does have some logical references to the lore, but it's not explicitly stated. And this is the idea that the Eldar gods are in fact not gods at all. Not in the sense that's portrayed anyway. And they're nothing like the gods of chaos as combative literal entities. Nor are they the seemingly sentient anthropomorphized entities as described in Eldar mythology. The Eldar gods could represent something more akin to metaphorical aspects of the Eldar themselves. And the gods may have simply become figures to better enable the Eldar to retell the power of these cultural traits in their mythology. The gods may be representative of the Eldar's powerful psychic presence, as well as the significant force present in all of their emotions and ambitions. We can find evidence for this in the Rise of the Inari book Wild Rider. The simplest example to give would be the one people know best, the avatars of the god Cain. Now in the modern age, the Eldar god Cain does not exist as a whole entity, but instead shards of him are supposedly present in all craft worlds. And commonly this is described where they sacrifice one of their exarchs who is given the title of the Young King. And this is in reference to an ancient Eldar known as Eldarnash. The Young King will be taken to the Avatar throne room on their craft world, although it has seemingly also happened on the battlefield, and after various ceremonies be apparently consumed by Cain with nothing left of their previous body. They then will walk forth as the Avatar of the bloody-handed god, Caelimmend Shacain. Now, in a sense, the most simple rationalization would be to say that those individuals are being consumed by the remnants of the entity Cain in order to bring him forth into mortal reality, much like demons are able to use a living host to breach reality from the warp. This thought process makes plenty of logical sense on the face of it. You could easily assume a similar process is happening here, except that, of course, I don't believe that's what's happening. The process of calling forth the avatar of Cain is not the same as what's occurring with chaos demons consuming mortals as a portal from the warp. And this is illustrated in Wild Rider when one of them calls forth the avatar as they are in battle. The description of once having trodden the path but holding back gives us the sense that it's not that they're channeling a god into their bodies as a vessel or being consumed completely, but this is something present in all Eldar, sitting behind their skin, present in their spirits, always fighting to get out. And that by letting go of their control over the true, raging psychic power in themselves, they allow it to become unleashed. And this is manifested as the Avatar Cain. And it is that psychic unleashing which ultimately consumes them. Because Cain represents their rage and bloodlust, their desire for war and violence. It's their sense of having to fight for survival. It seems likely the reason only the most well-disciplined warriors are allowed to become an Avatar would be because they are maybe the only ones able to keep it reasonably contained and in check and under control. For any others, once they unleash it, perhaps then it could not be contained, and as is commonly said, an Eldar who allows their emotions to run unconstrained will be ultimately destroyed by them. A description as follows from the Codex. When Eldar fight in battle, they divorce their mind from events around them, the spirit of Cain suffusing them. In this way, they're able to perform the horrific acts of violence that war necessitates, whilst keeping their minds free from its corruption. Eldar young kings allow themselves to be consumed by Cain, in a sense, but we're not seeing a god as you might envisage from a conventional understanding, so here's another short extract. More than once he had trodden that path, each time holding back the savagery and bloodlust that Caelimmend Shacain had placed in him, learning what he could have wore without succumbing to the lure of the bloody-handed one. Now the embodiment of Cain resided within him, he could no longer deny his nature. Head and heart warred with each other, but in the end, consensus was reached. The heart of Eldanesh kicked at his touch, welcoming and vital, and the Autarch felt the heat building beneath his fingers and let go his last restraint, welcoming the rush of battle, hearing the din like martial drums, the heat becoming the fire of vengeance. From within, the flames of Cain burst free, immolating him with black and red. His distending figure grew thrice in size, plates of pitted iron replacing flesh and armour, boiling magma searing through him where his blood had run moments before. The hand upon his breast wept thick blood, the curse for Eldanesh's murder, while in his other his spear transformed into Anaris, the Kinslayer, infamous Widowmaker, Sword of Myth. That which he had been faded, becoming just a part of the entity known as the Warshard, whose spirit he had assimilated in the Well of the Dead. He looked with the demigod's eyes at the scintillating play of energy that raged around him. Now it's important to note that Cain's avatar represents only a fragment of the original god Cain. It's difficult to fully envisage how such a figure would have been represented in the ancient times of the Eldar, but I'll expand on this later in the third video. Now, as I mentioned before, perhaps some of the gods themselves were physical entities to a degree, remembering the psychic weapons supposedly used in the war in heaven. And again, as I just said, we'll look more closely at this after we look at the mythology itself. What to keep in mind is that just as the gods of chaos, or I should probably say the three gods of chaos, are the reflections of human mortality, the Eldar gods are themselves reflections of the extreme nature of the Eldar spirit, and they should not be thought of as being the same as the chaos gods, which are distinct separate entities within the realm of the warp. While undoubtedly the Eldar gods are from the warp, they are seemingly, or we might say were seemingly, not fully constrained to it as the chaos gods are. Another good example comes from the novel Path of the Warrior, and this gives us further insight to the details regarding the Eldar pantheon and their mythology. One reference though gives a very clear indication of how the Eldar gods may not represent literal entities, but instead could represent more like the cultural knowledge developed by the Eldar themselves, and this has a somewhat mystical appearance. Maybe even the Eldar now no longer understand much of it, not as severely, yet not entirely dissimilarly to the Dark Age of Technology and the Imperium of Man in the 41st millennium. Especially when you consider much of the Eldar's knowledge was gained and or developed over a period of some 60 million years. You could forgive them for misplacing when and how they discovered certain achievements. It's reasonable that over time they had begun to attribute some of these more powerful cultural characteristics to their mythology. Now there is a passage which describes how Isha, the Eldar mother and god of life, had to give up a lock of her immortal hair so that Eldanesh, a great ancient hero of the Eldar and all of his descendants, could be healed by Isha's love for them. Now this in isolation just sounds like a piece of a mythological tale, except in Path of the Warrior it's actually referenced several times in direct regard to the Eldar's knowledge of healing. "You are in the care of Isha's healers," said the voice. Calandriel could not tell if it was male or female, so softly spoken was the tone. "Nothing can harm you here. You're safe. You must heal. You must release the power from the tress of Isha." "The pain is too much," whispered Calandriel. "The pain is not of your body, but of your spirit. The tress of Isha will free you from your pain. I am Soroth, and I will help you." "I have induced a paralysis for your own safety," Soroth said. "The wound has bound but a little. You must help your body complete the healing process. You must draw on the tress of Isha." 20 more were in the halls of healing, some of them fighting with little hope, against wounds even the Tress of Isha could not heal. It seems that the Tress of Isha, whilst described in the mythology, is also a very real thing, even in the modern Eldar civilization. So what was Isha? Was she a god, an old one? Was she perhaps some early Eldar who was dedicated to learning more of themselves, both in genetics and generally something that would be seen by humans as a great scientist? It's impossible to say, but as some Eldar have exclaimed, maybe in another million years, they may be talked about as if they were gods. So the sense of such things is not even lost on the Eldar themselves. It's also possible that the Eldar have even forgotten how they originally manifested the other gods, and this thinking not only allows us to look at the Eldar and their mythology in a different way, but it also more importantly enables us to look at the Chaos gods in the Warp in a different way, helping us to reach further conclusions later with them as well. As I said in the first video, whether you're looking at everything as having a process of cause and effect, and despite lacking the constraints of the mortal realm, like it or not, the warp is tethered to our reality. So consequently, however you might want to try and cut it, there are some things that even in the warp, with its lack of time and causality, cannot be avoided or changed. Yvraine of the Inari has this realization multiple times throughout the course of her journey to unleash Ennead. With a sudden sense of profound realization, Yvraine saw the pattern within, the cycle of the Eldari that she sought to turn full circle. Ennead was not simply the spirits of the Eldari, the sum of the reborn given life. She was the full incarnation of the Maiden, the Mother, and Crone. Ennead was Lilaeth, granter of visions, Isha, birth-giver to the Eldari, and Morai Heg, holder of fate. She stood reeling while the power of the revelation coursed through her. It made glorious and yet terrifying sense. Do the gods not also have souls? When the great enemy attempted to devour its Eldari creators, not all were consumed. Segarak escaped. Cain was shattered into the avatars of the Bloody Handed. Other fragments might have survived. A piece or pieces of every god scattered throughout the Eldari, born again and again into mortal form, just as the souls of the Eldari themselves. She almost fainted with the weight of understanding. Yvraine resolved that the revelation was true, but that she could not yet reveal the purpose to others. They seemed ignorant of their own divine heritage, and perhaps for good reason. The myths of the gods were full of deceit, infighting, and treachery. Better that none of them harboured a higher ambition than the service of Ennead. Before we turn to the mythology itself, that mention here of infighting and treachery, and there isn't a great deal mentioned of it, but as we learn about the early period of the Eldar and the war in heaven, you'll see that there was more going on here than just mythological figures acting out cultural tales for the sake of history. In fact, it seems with a strong degree of certainty that there was some form of civil war which occurred among the Eldar themselves during this time. In many Eldar tales, there are often references to hawks, falcons, and other birds, and it seems these may refer to early factions of Eldar pre-war in heaven, not dissimilarly to the differing Craftworld, Exodite, and Harlequin Eldar in modern age. Factions essentially representative of different sections in the Eldar civilization, maybe with different views, different outlooks. And this is why we also have a sense that the war in heaven refers collectively to the whole period of these times, one of unending war. Perhaps things became so muddled and clouded, or simply so much time just passed by that things had become unclear, that it was just easier to refer to the whole period as one war. Or that after a certain point, it was not really relevant what it was called, and the classic phrase of having been fighting for so long that they'd forgotten why they were fighting comes to mind. And so the whole thing becomes eventually known as the War in Heaven. If the Eldar did have a civil war at some point, as seems to be the case, this could have been a result of some simple internal disagreement, as unsurprisingly most civil wars are. The true origins of this could involve a variety of factors. Perhaps some Eldar felt that they must honour and stand with the Old Ones, while others felt that this was not their war to fight. Who knows, maybe some felt that they should be worshipped as gods, others not. Maybe this could explain for very practical reasons why these developed into these grand mythological tales. Regardless of any such speculation, the truth will likely never be known. As we now look into Eldar mythology, you'll see how, as I've said, the signs that point toward an internal Eldar conflict occurring toward the beginning of and during the War in Heaven. It is important to note that there are various versions of some details which overlap and contradict, and there are also no specific time periods whatsoever attributed, which would give us an idea of when these things may have begun or ended. There's nothing which signifies this. And with this in mind, I have attempted to combine the various mythological events into a more coherent timeline that makes sense to me. And there are no real subjective elements here. That is to say, I have added very little of my own rationalization or speculation. I have simply arranged all the established reference that I was able to find, albeit often very fragmented references. So, let's build this picture. All things have a beginning, and for the Webwe, that beginning took place at the Well of Harmonies. Some legends claim that this world was where Eldanesh first sired the Eldar people, and where Cain cast down his bloody spear to create the war in heaven. There are some philosophers who say the Well of Harmonies never existed, except as a metaphor, for everything is a cycle and begins nowhere, never ending. Whether there was once a single place from which sprang the existence of the Eldar Empire, ever it was that they were to be reborn again and again, every subsequent generation knowing tragedy. In the times before the War in Heaven, even before the Eldar, it is said that the gods schemed, planned, and engaged in games between one another. Cernus, Lord of the Hunt, was the lover of Lilaeth of the Moon, and they enjoyed the blessings of Asurion and the friendship of other gods, except that of Cain, for he desired Lilaeth for himself, not for her beauty, but solely because Cernus had him for himself. He tried to impress Lilaeth, his crude efforts were never anything that could best that of Kurnus, and he became consumed with the desire to possess her. Cain demanded Lilaeth from Isurien, who told Cain she would not be taken by force, and if he could not win her heart, then he could not have her. Cain was consumed with rage and swore that if he could not possess her, then no one would. Taking his sword, he carved into the void. Taking Lilaeth, he cast her into the void where no light could shine for 1,000 days. The heavens were dark until Kurnus, brave and resourceful, dared the rift and rescued Lilaeth so that her light would return. When the Eldar first rose, it is said that they were nourished by the tears of Isha. Isurien would give them wisdom to know themselves. Isha gave them love to know one another. Vol gifted them artifice to enable the crafting of their dreams. Lilaeth, goddess of dreams and fortune, gave them joy to know happiness. Kurnus gave them desire for them to know prosperity. Morai Heg, the crone, bestowed them with foresight that they should know their place in the world. And Cain gave them anger to protect all that the gods had given to them. During the earliest days of the Eldar, Isurien granted Eldanesh life, yet their world was barren and devoid of life. Seeing Eldanesh so saddened by the desolate nature of their home, Isha, mother of life and harvest, sharing his grief, shed a tear upon the Eldar's world. Her sorrow brought joy, and it filled the world with beauty and life, and Eldanesh felt no more sadness and gave thanks to Isha for what she had gifted the Eldar. The myth, known by the Eldar as the Tears of Isha, recalls how the Eldar race was born as the mortal children of Isha and Kurnus. Lilaeth dreamed that Cain would be torn into 100 pieces by a great mortal army. And when the god of war Cain learned of this, he resolved to destroy the Eldar. Knowing this, Isha wept. Isurien heard the weeping of Isha and learned of Lilaeth's dream and of Cain's plan. In order to save the Eldar, Isurien would divide the two realms, placing between them a barrier separating gods and mortals for eternity. Isha now only wept all the more because her mortal children had been separated from her, and so she and Kurnus pleaded with Vol the smith to help them. Vol knew Isurien would never change his mind, but his heart was softened by Isha's pleas. Vol would craft the first spirit stones to enable Isha to still see and talk to her mortal children. Isha and Kurnus taught the Eldar much of this knowledge, until one day Cain overheard Isha as she spoke to her children. Information he would immediately convey to Isurien, who was enraged that his commands had been disobeyed. The crone goddess Morai Heg sought to partake of the wisdom contained in her divine blood. Knowing there was only one with the power to harm a god, she sent her daughters to haunt their father Cain's steps with their piercing screams. The infernal noise drove Cain into a bloody rage that saw his mind begin to unravel. Promising an end to this curse, the crone goddess bade Cain cut off her hand that she might drink deep from her own veins. With this deed, Morai Heg gained the knowledge of blood, and the aspect of the Banshee was granted to Cain in return. Isurien told Cain that as Isha and Kurnus had betrayed him, he now considered them unworthy of his protection. Cain quickly made Isha and Kurnus his prisoners, and they were submitted to the fiery torments of Cain's confinement for many years. Bound by bonds of flame and scorching iron, the god and goddess were cast into a burning pit out of the sight of both mortals and gods alike. Of all the gods, only Vol would plead with Cain on their behalf. Eventually, he managed to strike a bargain and swore an oath to Cain that he would make 100 of the very finest swords in exchange for their release. Even a single blade forged by his hand was of inconceivable value. When the time came for Vol to deliver his weapons, he still had one unfinished blade, and to conceal the shortfall, Vol took an ordinary mortal blade and mixed it amongst the other masterworks. The reasons for this are unclear, as to whether this was part of an intentional deceit to create a weakness in Cain, or if Vol merely wanted to be sure to complete his oath on schedule for Cain. At first, Cain failed to spot the deception, and only later when Isha, Kurnus and Vol were far away did he discover the forgery. Cain roared with anger, called out to Vol as a cheat, and swore that he would have vengeance. This was the beginning of the long struggle between Cain and Vol, the war in heaven. Vol would now forge a great blade the final sword that he had failed to finish to settle his debt with Cain. It was vastly more powerful than any that had come before it, for as he had imbued the weapon with all the art of his mastery, he called it Anaris, meaning Light of Dawn. And with this sword in hand, he strode out to do battle with the War God. The fight was long, and Vol caused grievous wounds to his nemesis, but in the end, Cain overpowered the Smith God, toppling him out of heaven. It was as a result of this confrontation that Vol is said to have suffered the injuries that left him crippled, Cain shackling Vol to his anvil with chains of iron wrought by the Smith God himself. Anaris eventually passed into the hands of the mortal hero, Eldanesh. Hawk and Falcon, both messengers of the gods, were close friends and loved to compete and challenge one another. One day in a test, to see who could snatch their prey first, they swooped down upon it. Hawk was faster at first, but Falcon beat his wings the harder and dove ahead. Not willing to give up the victory, Hawk surged on, cutting in front of Falcon. Annoyed by his friend's maneuver, Falcon batted a wing against Hawk's tail, sending his rival off course. Hawk returned quickly, flying into Falcon to slow down his dive, and their wings became entangled and the two of them fell out of the skies. Their prey flew away, laughing merrily, and the both of them went hungry that night. Before the time of the war in heaven, Lord of the Eldar, Hawkfriend, lived Eldanesh, greatest warrior of the Eldar. He was their sworn defender, yet knew he could not bear this burden alone, and so he would reach out to Ulthanesh, the second greatest warrior of the Eldar. The friends fought side by side, and none could stand against them. Yet their ambitions were also at odds with one another, and Eldanesh would not entertain any such discussions, and so would banish his friend Ulthanesh, who was sent out to walk the desert. Weary, Ulthanesh would rest upon a rock, where he would sit and consider the wrongs of the universe and the dishonor put upon him. Cain saw the distress of Ulthanesh and saw an opportunity. He broke the tip of one of his fingers and cast it into the shadow of the rock. It became a scorpion and would sting Ulthanesh, the poison consuming him as he writhed in agony for days. Ulthanesh was strong, and he resisted the fever and pain of the poison and found himself suddenly at peace. He had survived and had not needed Eldanesh to do so. This brought to Ulthanesh the realization that he did not require Eldanesh's protection, that he was strong in himself and he could stand on his own. Thus, the House of Ulthanesh was founded and the strife of the Eldar began. A consort of the Great Hawk would retrieve Vol's mighty sword, allowing it to pass into the hands of the mortal hero Eldanesh. Eldanesh had previously feared in battle not for himself, but for the lives of his warriors, and it was in this doubt and fear that Cain would arrive on the battlefield. Fire-blooded, spear and shield in hand, the two shared no love, but Cain would protect the Eldar from their enemy. Eldanesh's fear was quashed by the presence of Cain, and the Eldar would know victory over their foes. With Cain now at his side and Anaris in hand, none could stand against Eldanesh and the might of the War God. Cain would congratulate Eldanesh on his victories and promised that there would be many more. Cain granted Eldanesh a vision by releasing a drop of his fiery blood upon Eldanesh's forehead. And the vision showed him a future where the enemies of the Eldar were slain in great numbers and the power of the Eldar grew beyond imagination. All would bow before the strength and greatness of Eldanesh and give thanks for his leadership. After this vision, Cain explained to Eldanesh that he would put aside his animosity toward the children of Isha if Eldanesh would swear loyalty to Cain himself. But Eldanesh had no care for the future drowned in blood that Cain had shown to him and refused his loyalty test. In an instance of pure rage, Cain would roar as he struck down Eldanesh, and the war in heaven began. It is said that the followers of Eldanesh caught his spilling blood in seven cups to keep it safe from the War God. Cain fought to reclaim the life and spirit of his victim, but Eldanesh's people had held the War God's armies at bay, preserving Eldanesh's spirit forever. Around the Eldar homeworld, three moons orbited: Leleth the Maiden, Kurnos the Hunter, and Eldanesh, who was set into the sky as a constant reminder of his bloody death. This red moon is said to be a symbol of bad fortune, and even if an Eldar of the current age should see the vision of a red moon, it is perceived as a bad omen, a sign of impending disaster. In the moment between Cain's blade landing upon Eldanesh and his death, Azurien, the Phoenix King, Lord of the Eldar gods, came down from heaven, and Eldanesh asked why it was that the Eldar had to die. Azurien would laugh. He would tell Eldanesh that he could not die, that the father of the Eldar would live on in the spirit and memory of his children, reborn anew in every generation. As they prospered, he would be immortal. As death gripped Eldanesh, Azurien gave him one final message. The gods had no descendants. Only they could truly die. Azurien, though, was so appalled by the murder of Eldanesh that he cursed the war god, so that ever after he was known as Cailar Mensha Cain. Cain, the bloody-handed god. At the dawn of the war in heaven, Azurien asked the crone goddess Moray Heg what would be the fate of the gods. She would look to the future and discern what would become of the gods. Long she would follow overlapping threads, following each on its course until the end of the universe, and yet she could find no answer for the Lord of Lords. All paths took her into a place of fire and death, where she could venture no further. To find the answer, she followed Cain the bloody-handed, who was seen to wage war on the other gods and mortals. She took from him a thimbleful of his blood. Returning, she set the blood of the war god upon her balance, and on the other side of her scales, she coiled the thread of fate belonging to Eldanesh. All was equal. Moray Heg returned to Azurien and told him that the fate of the gods was not his to know. The mortal Eldanesh and his people would decide if the gods survived or not. As Cain continued to unleash his rage upon the Eldar, Uthanesh refused to fight, claiming that this was an issue for the House of Eldanesh, not with all Eldar. Cain's wrath, though, was not so confined, and there were those in the House of Eldanesh who remembered well the bitter parting with Uthanesh. Those tainted by Cain fell upon Uthanesh's followers, and there was a great war between the houses. Cain saw his work, and he was pleased. Uthanesh finally relented and decided it was time for himself to enter the battle spear in hand, yet not to wage war upon the House of Eldanesh. No, his grievance was with Cain. Seeing that her children would forever be divided, the goddess Isha gave thanks to mighty Azurien, the All-Seeing, and asked that he part the torrent and allow the folk of Eldanesh and the folk of Uthanesh to once more come together. Azurien could not bring himself to intervene to such a degree, but he would pass a cooling breath to still the waters of division. This would freeze the rapids between the two and allow them to cross over. At times this would thaw and divide them again, but it would also freeze and unite them. This winter gulf could serve to create a union or a barrier between the two. Upon seeing their common enemy, the House of Eldanesh made peace with those of Uthanesh, and they fought together as the warriors of old. There were those, however, who were by now so consumed with the passion of war that they would slay any foe, regardless of their house. They became creatures of the bloody-handed god, turned now against their own kind. As the war in heaven raged on, Cain and his followers slew ever more Eldar of the two houses. Mother Isha feared the Eldar might be exterminated, and so she went before Azurien and begged for his intervention. Azurien also feared that Cain's unrelenting rage would destroy not only the Eldar, but the gods themselves. He agreed to aid Isha in her request, but that he required a lock of her immortal hair. This he bound into the hair of Eldanesh, that all of his descendants could be healed by Isha's love for them. When the war in heaven was at its height, the followers of Cain were the greatest enemy of both houses, for they had been consumed by their bloodlust and had given in to the whispers and promises of Cain. Yet one by one they fell. Cain would not relinquish them so easily. Instead, he would arm them so that they may continue the battles. Yet still they were defeated, until eventually Vol, the smith god, refused to forge any more supplies for the armies of Cain. Despite Cain's threats and tortures, Vol would not comply. Cain still would not release the spirits of those who had sworn their loyalty to him, so he would instead crush them together in his iron fist, so that the many would fight as one. Filled with the coursing wrath of Cain in their blood, the spirit warriors of the bloody-handed god slaughtered many children of Eldanesh and Uthanesh, yet there came such anger in them that these spirits now fell even to fighting among themselves. Each spirit vied for control of the whole, and they splintered. Cain's spirit army fell to ruin as they finally fled his grip. The war in heaven was over, with Azurien never having taken a side, instead looking on impassively. It is said that in doing so, he wisely remained the Lord of all. The fall of the Eldar itself is already widely known, and we'll look at this in more detail later. But for our purposes of the gods and the mythology, it's enough to say that millions of years later, the great enemy of the Eldar race would be born violently into existence. Moray Heg would be the first of the Eldar gods to be consumed by She Who Thirsts, as would Lilaeth and Asurion, seemingly destroyed as well. Cain, though, would bring his rage to She Who Thirsts, but such was Slaanesh's uncontestable strength, he was quickly overpowered. Slaanesh and then Khorne would fight for possession of Cain's spirit, but he belonged to neither of them, and as they both rested for control of Cain, ultimately the bloody-handed god would fall from heaven into the world of the mortals, shattering into fragments, no longer able to exist as one whole. Cain now awaits the call to battle when blood awakens him, and his desire for vengeance and war called forth from the infinity circuits of Eldar Craftworld. All of this was too much for Isha, who wept and cried out in despair at the horror unfolding. Before Slaanesh could consume her, Nergal, the Lord of Despair, would hear her cause and stole her out of the gaping maw of destruction, only to descend into a new, hellish fate. For Isha would find herself caged within the chambers of Nergal, where she, as the god of life and healing, is forced to taste all the poisons and corruptions that Nergal designs. Dependent on Isha's reactions, Nergal may rain them down upon the mortal realm, seeding worlds with plague and corruption, or vomit them back into his cauldron of blight. Some say Isha still whispers into the mortal realm to aid where she can, gifting mortals with the cures to heal and save them from the plagues and physical horrors of Grandfather Nergal. Sigarach, the Laughing God, it is said evaded the clutches of Slaanesh and escaped into the Webway, where he remains as the master of the Eldar Harlequins. And there it would all end, were it not for the Inari. Inaid is another god of the Eldar, who the Inari believe are meant to save all the souls of the Eldar. It is said that this can only occur when all the Eldar meet their final reckoning, and in that process, Inaid will rise to destroy Slaanesh and finally enable the Eldar to once again be reborn. Inaid promises that even after the last Eldar have died, they will become the reborn, a terrifying sacrifice for a race still coming to terms with their mortality in many ways, but through this, they would gain spiritual salvation and freedom from Slaanesh. The Inari are attempting to bring Inaid into existence, but doing so without all of the Eldar having to die. They are looking for the five Crone Swords to try and bring forth Inaid. Moray Heg gave up her hand to Cain so that she might drink her own blood and know her fate from those finger bones Vol would craft the Crone Swords. As M41 would come toward its close, Vrain had only found four of the five Crone Swords, and Inaid was only partially awakened. Yet the very evident power of Inaid was demonstrated when Vrain managed to call the Avatar of Inaid, which proved that their beliefs were not crazy imaginings, but a very real and tangible goal. This has led to the followers of Inaid, the Inari, continuing to grow in numbers and strength from the end of the 41st millennium. The Inari, though, may have other issues beyond Slaanesh and the need to try and bring more Eldar on board with their goals. Cultural conflict for one. Because the Inari accept Dark Eldar, Craftworld, Exodites, Corsairs, and Harlequins, they essentially accept any Eldar into their group. How the differences between all of those groups and the various ways they've learned to live and fight and evade Slaanesh will have to be resolved. What kinds of fractured groups and problems that could create are unknown. And another unknown is just what the future holds for the Inari. While they have had so far some debatable initial success, it's unlikely things will be smooth sailing. It's difficult to know if they have really achieved positive gains in the grand scheme of things, or have simply furthered the already very fractured Eldari more than they already were. The only major achievement was to shine for once a very real and very visible ray of hope. Now I should note that while it's still widely talked about, the only actual reference I could find which talks about this struggle between Khorne and Slaanesh over Cain is from first edition, so feel free to view that with skepticism. Where there are contradictions though are related to the order and events of Cain and Eldanesh. The following description is a transcribed imperial witness to an Eldari Harlequin dance. There was a time when the Eldar were not racked by fear, and did not live their lives in mortal apprehension of the dark fate that awaited them upon death. A warrior could meet foes without a thought for his mortal shell, his soul would live on, reborn as a phoenix from the flame. In that manner did the Eldar join their gods to wage war against the Ungur, the Catan, the immortal starspawn that plagued the universe with their eternal thirst and undying warriors. Their minions, the Silvered Host, parted like a sea before Cain's wrath, and his followers, the most battle-hardened of all, blazed a flaming path across the galaxy. Orthanesh and Eldanesh, noble kings of their houses, fought at Cain's side. Lanthrolak the Swift and Jirelia, thrice blessed, led their peoples, and none could stand before them. Then came Kaelus Rahr, the Deathbringer. Its rampage stained the stars with blood, and none could stand against it, for it wielded the power of death itself. Populations fell before its scythe. Its very gaze killed even the greatest of Eldar heroes. Those that died lost everything, even their souls. But the gods of the Eldar had strengths other than force of arms. The greatest among the Soul Dancers had begun to convince the Catan to turn their hunger inward, to consume their brethren in unholy feasts of starflesh. Kaelus Rahr took its blade to its kin and butchered them without mercy, as it had the sons of Isha. While the Deathbringer sought ever darker ways to slake its unquenchable thirst, Cain was not idle. He struck a bargain with Vol the Smith God in exchange for Kurnos and Isha's release from Cain's dungeon. Vol would forge 100 swords for Cain's war against the Ingir. Thus were born the swords of Vol, the Blade Wraiths. Cain led his people to war once more, his rage incandescent, the remnants of his army aflame with the heat of vengeance. 100 Eldar, each armed with a Blade Wraith, faced a horde of silvered Necrontyr, so vast the horizon glittered with metal bodies in every direction. Yet they knew no dread. The Eldar fought in a great circle, the swords of Vol flashing, and the Necrontyr could not penetrate their defence. The soul might contained within the swords invigorated their wielders, and every blow smashed apart an unholy foe. Cain was unstoppable, and his warriors fought with the knowledge that their god was pleased. The battle lasted 7 days and 7 nights before the Eldar began to fall. The Catan's servants had found a weak spot in the circle. Lanthrolak the Swift was tiring, his face pale, his imperfect sword dull and blunt. The ring of warriors buckled and broke, and the ground shook as Cain bellowed his anger. Vol had cheated him. One of the swords was lifeless. From the ground beneath them burst Kaelus Rahr, the Nightbringer, and the Eldar fell back, for they knew their doom was at hand. With a gesture, Kaelus Rahr slew all those near it. With a glance, it condemned the souls of great warriors to an eternity of dust. With a great roar, Cain levelled his spear and charged. Scythe and spear clashed over a mound of corpses in a struggle that tore the skies asunder. Cain's speed and skill were breathtaking, but the Nightbringer was a being of shadow. The spear of Cain could not find its mark. Kaelus Rahr let its foe exhaust his rage with the patience of death. Without warning, the Nightbringer swung mightily with his scythe and aimed for Cain's throat, but Cain had heeded the counsel of the Laughing God well, and as the Nightbringer's form became solid to deliver its blow, Cain lunged and the tip of his spear drove clean through the Catan chest. Kaelus Rahr burst apart in an explosion of silvered shards that nearly cleft Cain in two as the Catan essence tore free of physical form. The silvered warriors around him fell to the earth as the impact spread ever outward, returning to the ground from whence they came. Soon, only Cain remained, howling his victory. However, all was not well. Shards of the Catan flesh, driven deep into Cain's body by the cataclysmic demise of his foe, melted in the fires of the war god's wrath. The silver poison flowed into his bloodstream and forever tainted his physical incarnation with the aspect of the Reaper. Kaelus Rahr cannot truly die, for it is death incarnate. Raging at his defeat, its quintessence howled throughout space, entering every one of the Eldar race and cursing them with the terror of the grave. Thus it was that the seed of the Eldar's downfall was sown, and ultimately, the way of reincarnation was closed to them forever. Now, it's difficult to know how much of the story is accurate because this description overlaps with other accounts of Eldar mythology. It also contradicts more recent accounts that describe how it was the Necron themselves who were responsible for the destruction of the Nightbringer Catan. In the Eldar mythology, the war in heaven begins by Cain slaying Eldanesh, but here, in the Harlequin's remembrance, we see the houses of the two Eldar heroes fighting alongside Cain. So you would assume that this takes place seemingly after the Eldar's own internal conflict, which fits somewhat into this confusing timeline. We do know that the Catan were being destroyed only toward the end of the war in Heaven, and the Nightbringer is credited as bringing the fear of death to all mortal races. So this would again only be occurring late in the timeline after much damage had already been caused to the galaxy. More interestingly though, is that reference to the destruction of the Nightbringer and its bringing about the end to the Eldar's ability to reincarnate. This is a difficult and questionable statement, because as far as we know, the Eldar only lost their ability to be reborn from the warp after the fall. So this reference is unclear. It could simply allude to the fact that the Eldar became aware that while they could be reborn, there was such a thing as death that they were entirely unfamiliar with from their own perspective previously, before the Nightbringer destroyed them and consumed their souls. But also this description of silver poison flowing into Kane's bloodstream, it could be a reference to this Catan somehow infecting the Eldar's psychic shared presence, or perhaps diminishing it in some way. It could be that the Eldar were unable to so easily resist the predatory nature of the warp and found it more difficult to safely reincarnate, except that this grates somewhat against the belief of the Inari that when the Eldar God of the Dead finally destroys Slaanesh, the Eldar will again be able to reincarnate from the warp, which would eliminate the fear of death. But then I suppose that's the entire point of Inaid. Either way, the description doesn't really sit well with me, as it also clashes with some other details about the Eldar's soul. In a worst case scenario, it could even point to perhaps a suggestion that the Catan, as we know, do shatter into shards when destroyed, and that perhaps these shards entered Kane, that then when he himself was later shattered, these shards, which were apparently distributed to the Eldar craft world so as to enable his presence as the Avatar to come forth, could perhaps be Catan shards or elements or pieces of this. Again, I think it's quite a stretch and it's only coming from this one reference, but it's very unclear about the descriptions here and how they fit into the whole picture. Now, the Eldar soul for me is actually critical to all of this. We learn fragmented pieces from the mythology about it here and there. We will get into the meat of this in our next video and I'll lay it all out for you, but it has heavy implications for me on the origins of the Chaos Gods. The Eldar mythology is one of the more difficult pieces of lore to wrap your head around. This is mainly because of how vague and symbolic much of the descriptions surrounding them seem to be. There does seem to be something of a physical material element to them, yet it also seems very likely that they're nothing more than metaphors or an allegory for the Eldar themselves and the various ways their culture and technology have developed over millions of years. So much of it is told as ancient tales with little context of actual events, so we're left to infer and read between the lines, and there are a few references to this time. For example, he thought about the endless lives he had lived, lives he did not recall but could still feel in his immortal soul, and of the great cycles of the universe. How many wars in Heaven had there been, he asked, struck by sudden thought. Necrontyr and Eldari created these vaults together? Did all of this happen before? Scant references like these, though, are all we have to even vaguely reference this time beyond the mythology or Necron accounts, and it's unclear if we'll ever really know the truth. Some might say it's the pursuit of knowledge that's important, if indeed you ever truly know anything. After all, what is knowing? And for the Eldar, time and perception are perhaps the most important part of their entire civilization. It may be this is why they teach their history through dance and culture, more than endless archives that after a certain point become more problematic than useful, as the Imperium itself has seen. For the Eldar, perhaps the most important thing for us to know is that the literal details may not be all that important. It's the larger understanding that is more necessary. It's something few among their own toward the end of the 41st millennium have come to understand. Armed with such knowledge, it's possible that the Eldar, who have stared total annihilation in the face and been drifting lost for millennia, may have finally the vision to spark a rise that could position them once again as a galactic power with no limitations. This should be something that concerns the Imperium of Man significantly. The Imperium and mankind who are now ever more consumed by their own affairs. For it is known that the Eldar at one time had the power to extinguish stars and planets and then rebuild them. They had technology that allowed them to simply imagine a thing and that it would manifest: a chair, a gun, a soldier, an army, a planet, an armada. They had this power, and far more importantly, they had the ability to be reborn over and over again with no fear of death. And everything we know about the Old Ones, my personal inclination, is that this was not part of evolution, this was by design. The Eldar were designed to fight a war of unending attrition, and if they're able to recapture that most powerful aspect, this could be immensely threatening to the rest of the galaxy. If the Inari and Inaid can destroy Slaanesh, for the Eldar and the galaxy as a whole, the ultimate impact upon other races could be devastating. The Eldar are seen by other races as broken and insignificant. Indeed, as once the Eldar had looked down upon all of them, the Inari are determined to see that this will all change.